This is a CBC podcast.
CBC podcasts are supported by HP Print Studio. Express your brand with HP Print Studio. Find free, customized templates to build your business identity, like letterhead, business cards, and shipping labels. Start the journey at www.hp.ca/print.
Hi there, I'm Gian Gomeshi. This is Q, the podcast. Okay, on your program today, live from London, author Sebastian Fox is both shaken and stirred. The acclaimed British novelist took on the job of writing the latest James Bond novel, and now it's a worldwide bestseller. Sebastian Fox, first up. And Shazia Mirza, the outspoken comic and columnist, is making it on her own terms in the comedy world, not afraid to poke fun at and defend her Muslim faith. She'll join me in about 30 minutes. Plus, Helen Couchman, the British photographer, takes us behind the scenes with Olympic site construction workers in Beijing. All that and some ting ting too. This is Q. Well, our first guest today on this very first London show will need to be patient with me because he must be getting quite tired of introductions like this. His name is Fox. Sebastian Fox. He is a commander of the British Empire, a former journalist and editor with The Guardian and The Independent newspapers, and the world-renowned author behind literary bestsellers Charlotte Gray and Birdsong. His book Human Traces, published in 2005, was described by critic Sir Trevor Nunn as a masterpiece of this or any other century. Most recently, Sebastian Fox has been on a special assignment with one of England's favorite heroes. Fox channeled Ian Fleming, the famed writer of the James Bond books, to pen Devil May Care, the newest installation in the Bond book series. It joins his other works on the global bestseller list, and I'm pleased to welcome Sebastian Fox live to me in studio here in London. Hello, sir.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good to have you here. Let's get your microphone on there. Now you can say hello to me.
Hi, for the second time. Now you can hear me.
Hello, Canada. Redux. It's a pleasure to have you on this program. It's interesting to hear how this book came about. I've heard you say that you didn't actually, when you were contacted about writing a James Bond book, you had some trepidation. You weren't sure if it was for you. And as a writer of historical fiction, it doesn't necessarily follow that you'd be a James Bond writer. What changed your mind and made you want to do it?
I think when the idea was first put to me, it seemed to me ridiculous, preposterous, because the book that I published just before then was Human Traces, which you referred to just now, which is a 650-page book about psychiatry and consciousness and set in the late 19th, early 20th century and about, you know, what makes human beings different from other species in the world and so on. You know, it's a novel, it's a story, but these are the themes of it. It's a very, very serious book. And the thought that I might write a thriller, I mean, albeit a rather specialized kind of thriller, a James Bond story, seemed ridiculous when I don't really read thrillers. I don't really know much about the genre at all. But I was tempted. I was intrigued, as you would be, and partly because I was so exhausted by all the seriousness of what I'd been doing that, you know, so it was like someone saying, hey, do you want to come outside and play football for half an hour?
Well, of course, you do. Right. But you were worried that Ian Fleming, that the writing was going to just be pulp fiction. You hadn't read the Bond books, had you?
I hadn't read the Bond books since I was about 12 or 13 years old. And then I read probably three or four maybe maximum. Then, like everyone else, I went to see the movies, you know, which were already coming out by, you know, at that time. Sean Connery was then James Bond. But anyway, I went to see the Fleming family and they put this proposition to me. Would you like to do this book? It's just a one-off. It's a special centenary celebration and so on and so forth. And the deal was, I said, look, okay, I'm not sure about this, but I'll go and read Ian Fleming's own books. And if I like them and I can see a way of doing something similar that would be, you know, in the spirit of the whole thing, then I'll do it. So I went away and I read them from start to finish chronologically. And they were much better than I expected they would be. I mean, very much of their period, but the most important thing about them was simply that Fleming created this sense of danger, of jeopardy about this character. Within about 10 pages, you thought, oh dear, he's in a bad circumstance here, in a bad situation, and he's only got soft shoes on, he's only got a tiny little gun, which is really no good to anybody in his pocket. And, you know, the odds are overwhelmingly against him, and you kind of worried for
him. And he wasn't a superhero.
No.
In those early books.
No, he was a guy, you know, very much more like you or me. I mean, okay, he had a gun, but it was a small one, not a powerful thing. But apart from that, he was someone who relied on his wits, really. He was driven by, you know, patriotism, a devotion to his boss, this strange, grumpy ex-naval officer, and to the service, which is a mysterious organization, which is kind of part Secret Service spying thing, but also part global policeman. But it's essentially a very sort of patriotic thing that he's involved in. And the character of Bond developed a lot over the years through the movies until by the end of the sort of the 20th century, the Pierce Brosnan films, you have what you just said, a sort of superhero kind of guy. Yeah. He's more akin really to Batman or Spider-Man or Superman, really. But that's not how he began. And in fact, it's not how he's carrying on. I think they, you know, the filmmakers have very cleverly reinvented him with
Daniel Craig. Yeah. But you made an interesting decision. So you read these books and you feel comfortable with it. And you know, okay, I'm going to... And then you decide that you're not going to write this book like... as Sebastian Fox, the best-selling, renowned British author, but you're going to write the book in the style of Ian Fleming. Why did you make that decision?
Well, I couldn't write it in my own style because they weren't my people. They weren't my characters. You know, I didn't invent Bond and Miss Moneypenny and M and so on. And, you know, I write about what people are thinking and feeling and so on. And we don't know what Bond feels, if he feels anything. We don't really know what he thinks about things. So if I'd written it in, as I tend to write books, though, of course, I have a different style depending on the book. You know, for instance, Englebee, my most recent book, is written in a very conversational first-person style.
Right.
Human Traces is written in a very old-fashioned sour style with long sentences. But none of this would have been appropriate to Bond. It wouldn't have worked. And indeed, there were times in the story when I wanted to slow it down a little bit to give the reader time to sort of, you know, collect their thoughts. And so at that point, I would try to show Bond kind of collecting his thoughts and taking stock of the situation. And it was very difficult because, you know, Bond doesn't really have this kind of inner life that is the stock in trade of novelists like me. So it only made sense to write it in the style of Fleming, which is in any case... a fairly straightforward. It's a good style for the job.
It's quite bold, though. It's quite bold to on the cover of the book, Sebastian Fox writing as Ian Fleming, even for someone as prolific and successful as you, to say I'm going to step into Ian Fleming's shoes. Were you concerned about that? I mean, you have played at writing in someone else's voice before in your short book Pistache. I'm thinking the book features essays written in the voices of Enid Blyton, Martin Amis, Jane Austen, William Shakespeare. But were you concerned about stepping into Ian Fleming's voice and style?
No, it was quite easy to work out how he did it. I mean, he writes as a journalist, really, and I trained as a journalist, and Ian Fleming and he learned how to write as a correspondent for Reuters news agency in Moscow. And I recognize the style. There are no adjectives. There are short sentences. There are no semicolons. Lots of verbs. It's very clear and factual. And it's a good style for getting getting a story told and getting maximum information across. The only thing that was harder for me to catch was not the style itself, but the tone of voice. And there's a kind of tone that Fleming has sometimes, which gave the books their flavour, which is a rather condescending tone in which he is saying under the lines, beneath the lines, he's saying, I am taking you, reader, into a world that's really a little bit beyond and above you. You're going to be a little bit out of your depth here. Mm. But James Bond and I, we know about this world of casinos and smart tuxedos and fancy drinks and so on. So, you know, we'll look after you here. Is a slightly snobbish, condescending tone, which, funnily enough, is not off-putting. It's kind of exciting, and it gave the books their glamour, really.
Situate, if you can, for me, James Bond in contemporary England, because and this is our first show here in London. We're going to be here for a few days. One of the things we're trying to discover is the cultural zeitgeist of London. And it seems to me that the original James Bond was something of a throwback to the proper the British Empire, to a certain extent. I mean, just in his integrity and who he was. Do you still see Britain as needing that kind of hero? Where do you think James Bond fits into today's UK?
Well, I don't think Bond was as you describe him, in fact. I think he was the first British sort of hero who was actually rather unsportsmanlike and ungentlemanly. And Ian Fleming was at considerable pains to stress his cruelty and coldness. And I think that was another thing that made him so popular at the time in the 50s and 60s, was that he was new in that sense. And he
So the eloquence and the tuxedo were a front.
Yeah, but they were a front, yes. I mean, but they were, you know, bad people wear smart clothes. That's okay. That wasn't difficult to get our heads around. The function that Bond served was to make a lot of people reading in the late 50s feel that Britain still mattered in the world, because although we'd won with the help of our Canadian and other allies, won the Second World War, you know, we'd lost an empire and we'd lost all our money. And, you know, kids like me who grew up in the 50s and 60s, you know, it was a drab, dour place. You weren't allowed to travel abroad because there was a controls on how much money you could take out. I mean, rationing was still going on in the 1950s. And here was this guy hopping on a jet, you know, going off all over the world with a little gun and eating lovely food, drinking great. The sun is always shining too in Bond. Always, always the sun is shining. And he meets these girls and they're all so willing. And this was, you know, a fantastic picture to represent to people at that time.
Although he isn't necessarily willing in your book, I've noticed. He doesn't he doesn't take it up as much as he could, the offers from these women he meets.
Well, it takes him a little time. Ian Fleming left James Bond in a pretty poor state at the end of Fleming's own series of books. So in realistic terms, I had to give him you know, a little sabbatical to sort of recover his full force. But by midway through the book, he is firing on all cylinders, I assure you.
But sorry, I cut you off. I mean, you've reset it for me. So there's a desire to recapture the British greatness. This is when you're saying when Fleming was writing these through the 50s and into the early 60s. What now?
I think Bond now has become really largely a film character, and Eon Films, who did the deal with Ian Fleming in the 50s or 60s, whenever they did the deal, have developed the character through the Fleming books and then out of them using stories of their own into this kind of superhero of the late 20th century. And they've now reinvented him as a much more down-to-earth character through Daniel Craig, but I don't think that it's easy to relate the James Bond of today to, in any kind of serious way, to British culture. I mean, he's a kind of fantasy figure, and even at the time, Ian Fleming referred to his books dismissively as sort of pillow book fantasies of a fevered schoolboy mind or something like that. So I think, you know, you can get a bit too solemn about you know, Bond and British culture. It's a story, it's an adventure.
I wonder what this has been like for you after so much success with your historical novels, Birdsong, Charlotte Gray, Human Traces. You seem to have surprised your followers with Engleby, which you mentioned, which is set in the 1970s. And then this book, Devil May Care, you're writing as Ian Fleming. Have you enjoyed a freedom of not having to be Sebastian Fox, who writes historical fiction?
I never really think of my books as historical novels in that sense, which seems to be a kind of genre thing of, you know, people dressed up in, you know, long gowns and saying, ooh, gadzooks, my lord. You know, they're not like that.
You don't write with a fountain pen?
No, they're novels which happen to be set in various different decades. But yeah, actually, most great novels are historical. You know, if you look at the great novels of the 19th century that are sort of, you know, famous, you know, War and Peace and all these, a few of them are set at the time of writing. Most of them are set back 10, 30, 40, 50 years, and that's all I've done. But to answer your question about feeling liberated, it was fun. It was like a holiday. And, you know, I think I've sort of earned it after 25 years or whatever it is, sort of striving at these very serious books to have 6 weeks off doing something fun. But I'm back writing, you know, one of my own. And although doing the Bond book was, as I say, it was 6 weeks of intensely good fun. It made me laugh when I was writing it. It's quite funny, I think. I hope so. I'm, you know, I wouldn't do it again. It's like a sort of holiday romance, you know. I don't regret it. I'm really pleased. But, you know, now I'm home. I don't want to receive a call from anyone I met on holiday.
Interesting. Yeah. Even as successful as it's been. When you talk about the great novels being set in the past, that's a good segue into what I wanted to ask you. But I understand you've found contemporary Britain, you say, an impossible subject to write about. Why?
Well, that's a question which I've struggled hard to explain to myself as much as to anyone else. And if you could come up with a convincing answer to that, then I think you'd have a real key to understanding British society. But the fact of the matter is that the great contemporary American writers, the very famous ones we all know, Philip Roth, Updike, Bellow, and so on, they've all taken as their subject, the America outside their window, the America at the end of the road.
On the road, yeah.
And they've written very serious, deep, realistic books about that. And if you were told that the new Philip Roth, the guy is a teacher in Columbia University and so on, you think, that's interesting, and it's going to be about Jewish emigration, it's going to be about political correctness, it's going to be about the state of the union, where we are, European history, American history, and it's going to be about sex and death, and it's going to be deep and resonant. But if you hear that a contemporary British writer, his main character, is in a realistic novel, sort of teaches at London University, you think it's going to be some kind of campus comedy. And, if you say Chicago in a Saul Bellow voice, people think, ah, yes. But if you say, Leicester or Neasden, people just laugh. There is something.
Why?
I don't know. There's something about British society. It's something about English society. It's not true of Scotland, for instance. There's something about English society which is just automatically self-parodying. It's very, very weird. But the success novels about contemporary England have not been realistic novels. They've all been surreal or, magically realistic or whatever you want to call it. We don't have a Bellow or an Updike or a Roth. The creature does not exist, and it's just some weird dislocation in English society.
Having said that, I understand this new book you're talking about is a Dickensian epic that's set in 2008.
The one I'm writing now, since
having said what you've said,
yes, having said what
you,
I said,
you will now undo it.
Yes, I've tried to find a way. To me, it's the big conundrum, and it's the big white whale that this is the one that someone has to go out there and harpoon, and so I am going to try and do it now. I've written about 40,000 words, and it'll be about 200,000 words. And, when I finish this, I'll go back to my little office and write 40,000 and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But already I am finding that it's becoming slightly satirical in a way that I didn't really expect. And, if that's the only way to be, fine, because if you think of, Vanity Fair, or if you think of Bleak House or Our Mutual Friend, or these big sort of 19th century novels, Vanity Fair, the very title suggests it's highly satirical of society. And I think, satire is okay.
But what about someone like Hanif Qureshi? Would he not be capturing contemporary London and England?
Yeah, that's possible, but from a kind of an angle.
Right, an outsider, potentially.
And that's also true. That is a good point, that people whose families are, first or second generation in this country, they do bring a kind of freshness. Or Zadie Smith, actually, is another example. Though I would argue that they're not really realistic, those novels. But that is one way. But for a kind of, old-style English guy like me, and indeed of my generation, it has proved an elusive thing.
Let me ask you this as I wrap up with you. You don't look that old style to me, sitting across from the table. You look pretty young. But from what I understand, this new book, you tell me if I'm wrong, 12 characters, including a footballer, a hedge fund manager, a tube train driver. I talked in my opening of this show about London as a place of renewal and rejuvenation. How would you describe your London right now?
I think everything you said in the opening is probably true, but it doesn't necessarily ring true with a resident, because when you actually live in someone, I've lived here for 30 years, it's hard to kind of to see it from the outside, really. And so I've never really bought into any of the cliches about English stereotypes and English people being whatever we're supposed to be, reserved and polite and all that kind of stuff. So I don't really buy into all those stereotypes are dead, because, they were never really alive to me. But certainly it is noticeable coming on the subway, on the tube, as I did just now to come to the studio. You don't see many old-style white British people speaking, as I'm speaking to you, and it's quite true about the large variety of languages. But London's always been a city of vast immigration. It's always been in flux. It's always been changing, and that's what's given its vitality. But I think it's also a stupendously rich city. That's what's really changed, I think, perhaps most noticeably in
materially rich. You mean?
Yeah, materially rich over the last 10 years or so. Just amazing sums, and the British economy is driven from the city of London, the financial district. And that does have an effect on central London, on property prices and so on and so forth. And that has in turn, I think, affected the sort of balance of who lives here. So you may have sort of immigrant groups will stay for a generation, but then they tend to move out because they're squeezed out. And what were originally kind of slum areas in the East End, as every city has, then become colonized by richer people. There's a kind of endlessly sort of revolving door of economic progress. But I mean, I'm sure this isn't peculiar to London, but I do think the amazing wealth generated by the city has had a huge, by the City of London, has had a huge effect over the last 10 years.
It's a great pleasure to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
British author Sebastian Fox, he writes as Ian Fleming in his latest book, Devil May Care. It is published in Canada by Doubleday.
This is Q, the podcast, with Gian Gameshi from CBC Radio 1.
Shazia Mirza has impeccable timing. She got onto the British comedy circuit just before September 11th, 2001. After that date, her life as a Muslim woman in England became an instant source of provocative material. She shocked, delighted, and offended audiences in 2001 when she kicked off a routine in a London comedy club with this joke: "I'm Shazia Mirza. At least that's what it says on my pilot's license." To top it off, Shazia was wearing a head covering or hijab at the time. Soon after uttering that deadpan line, she became one of the hottest comedy acts in Europe, with big ambitions to conquer North America as well. Here in England, she's become a popular and award-winning weekly columnist with the New Statesman magazine, and she just performed at the Glastonbury Festival this past weekend. Recently, she's been collecting more American fans as one of the 12 finalists on the US TV show Last Comic Standing 6. Here's a bit of her routine from an early round.
I don't smoke, I don't drink, I've never drunk alcohol in my life because it's against my religion. What isn't? But I have taken ecstasy. Because it doesn't say anything in the Quran about ecstasy. But sometimes I get hate mail, you know. I had an email last week from a Muslim man. It said, "You do comedy, you're a prostitute." Now I had to point out to him that prostitutes earn more money. But what he doesn't realise is that I'm now using him as material. So effectively, he's my pimp. Now, my parents, you know, they really want me to get married, but the thing is, Muslim men, they don't really want to marry me because I speak.
That is Shazia Mirza performing on Last Comic Standing 6. Sadly, she's no longer standing. Shazia was eliminated on last week's show, but she is sitting in our London studio right now. It's a pleasure to have you here. Welcome, Shazia.
Hello. Hi.
How are you?
I'm all right, thanks. Was that off Last Comic Standing?
Yeah.
Really? Yeah, it sounds like an American audience.
Why is that?
You can always tell the difference between an American audience and an English audience. English audience laughs and they're very polite. Americans go well over the top. Whatever laughter you get from an English audience for one joke, Americans will top it by times three.
And I can tell, that's a good thing.
That's
right?
A good thing.
I'm
going to
move the microphone closer to you.
That's a good thing, because you get like three times the laughter. But you can hear, if they like something, they really go for it and they scream and go, "Ah!" In England, people are too reserved to do that.
Yeah, people are more reserved in the as part
and
of the British Empire.
Applaud.
Right.
In America, they just go, "Ah!"
They scream at you.
They do.
Do you have to change your act when you're performing in the United States? Do you adapt for an American audience?
Yeah, I have to, because there's certain things that Americans won't understand that we have over here. Like, we have the pound shop over here, so they won't understand that over there. They have the 99-cent shop. And a few references like that. But generally, I think...
Just make the conversion in their heads? You can't say pound shop?
No, I'm afraid not. I mean, it's too complicated.
In a recent Statesman column, this is where you write your biweekly column, you say, "I can often look in an audience and forecast just how the gig will go. I'm often right." So yeah. What do you look for in an audience, and how do you know how the gig will go?
Well, so I can walk into an audience and it'll be full of men with a few hairs on their head, thick glasses, looking very stern and old. And they are often white, middle-class Guardian readers or Telegraph readers.
Right.
And they're very civilised and they're here to analyse your comedy rather than laugh at it. Whereas if I go
it's
to
more a, sociological.
Oh, yes. Let's deconstruct.
What is this woman doing?
Yeah,
how did
what
she
is
get,
she saying?
Yes.
She's made a joke about wearing the headscarf.
And you can deduce this from the amount of hair on their head and the glasses they're wearing.
And
amazing.
And the way they don't move their face for the whole time. But then they'll come up to you at the end of the show and go, oh, that was hilarious. But when they're in there, they don't laugh once. But when they come up to you at the end, they go, oh, that was hilarious. I thought it was really funny.
And who? What kind of an audience do you know is going to laugh, and besides being Americans?
America. Well, when I performed in Miami, which I'd never performed in Miami before, and I walked into the audience, and I actually didn't know if they were going to like it or not, because, you know, I'm British and I'm Asian, and that's not normal in America. There don't seem any female Asian comics.
Right.
And I didn't know how they were going to react. I didn't know if they would get my jokes. And then there were some guys on the front row with cowboy hats on. And I thought, oh, they're not my sort
of crowd.
It's
a bad sign, yeah.
I just thought, my God, this is Texas. Texas is on the front row.
Right.
And I thought,
in Miami.
Yeah.
How odd.
Yeah. They were wearing big hats. So I thought, you know, J.R. Ewing, that's all I know of big hats. And right. I thought, they're not going to get this. But I was wrong. They loved it.
Sounds like you were engaging in your own stereotyping of the audience.
Yeah.
Sazia Mirza,
who
may be a victim of stereotyping. Look what you've done.
You've
turned
help
it around.
But judge people, can you? And judge an audience. You think, if I walked into an audience full of skinheads, I think, oh, they're not going to like me. We've got nothing in common. You know, why English blokes who drink a lot, who look a bit rough. And then I think, nah, we're not going to get on. We've got nothing in common. But a lot of times I'm wrong.
But in seriousness, who do you, when you're devising, creating your act, your humor, who are you thinking the audience is? Is it fellow Muslims? You never think of the audience.
I never think of the audience. I always think of myself. And I always think, that doesn't just go for comedy. It goes
right,
for life.
In general.
Yeah.
I don't think of anyone.
Else. Yeah. I just think of myself.
That's probably,
I think, what do I want to say? What do I want to write about? If I think it's funny, then they might think it's funny. If I don't think it's funny and I'm doing it for them, what's the point of me doing it?
But is there, I know that, for example, certain comedians of certain ethnicity, you know, an Iranian comic like Maz Jobrani goes over in front of an Iranian crowd differently and can relate to them in a different way than, say, in front of an Anglo crowd that is not Iranian. So I'm wondering if it's the same for you, if you particularly, you do the inside intra-Muslim jokes when you got the Muslims in the crowd.
I do the inside jokes on the outside and the outside jokes on the inside. That's how it works. I do really well in a non-Muslim crowd. In a Muslim crowd, they just hate me.
Are you serious? No.
Well, I think I do better in a non-Muslim crowd because in a Muslim crowd, I find that their sense of humour is very different to a British sense of humour. If I go to a normal comedy club, which is full of multicultural and full of white people or black people, they love it because they are laughing at me, at my jokes from the outside in. They're laughing at things that they would not normally be able to laugh at because it's not someone like me telling the joke. When I'm in a Muslim crowd, I do jokes about my family and my upbringing. Sometimes it's too close to the bone for these people.
Right.
And a lot of these people have not been brought up with comedy. You know, and so they're not used to laughing at themselves in a way because what I'm doing is making jokes about myself, which could be them.
Back in 2001, when you really started to grab headlines as the hijab or burqa comic, were you prepared for how much attention you would get?
No.
Bad and good?
No, and I thought it was a load of rubbish, actually, because I started comedy in 2000. And I was not wearing the hijab then because I've never worn it in real life. And I was just doing my normal stand-up. And I was getting a bit of attention then. Then 9/11 happened and I carried on. And I got more attention for doing what I was already doing before. But because 9/11 happened, they associated the two and they thought, oh, isn't this funny, you know, in this serious time, this woman is making these jokes. But it was what I'd always been doing before. And then later on in 2002, I wore the hijab for 6 months because I was trying out a character for my stand-up. Then I stopped wearing it because it it's caused too much ridiculous attention, and it was not about my comedy anymore. It was about this Muslim woman doing stand up, which was nothing to do with my stand up.
And you got death threats?
I had a lot of hate mail at that time. But you know, I've had hate mail
from
since,
who?
I mean, I've had hate mail since doing Last Comic Standing.
Why? From who do you get the hate mail? Is it racist hate mail, or is it?
I've had hate mail. I had an email the other day when from somebody in America, a young Muslim guy, who said, "I saw you on Last Comic Standing in Miami, and I don't think that you should be doing stand-up comedy because Muslims are already portrayed really badly in the world, and by you making jokes, then that's making it worse."
That's an understandable position that somebody might take, right?
But I think it's making it better. God, we're not famous for our sense of humor, are we? God, if people laughed at us a bit more, they might like us a bit more. But
This is the same thing people sometimes say about Little Mosque on the Prairie too. This new show that's gotten a lot of attention in Canada. Are we undermining ourselves as Muslims by making these jokes? You know, if people don't know a lot
but
about
But Jews
us.
Have done it since the beginning of time. Christians have done it, and the Jews, people like the Jews. The best comedians are Jews. They've got great sense.
So the anger actually comes from other Muslims mostly.
I had a couple of emails from that about that. And then the other, I had an email from an American guy, a white American guy, who said, you shouldn't make jokes about yourself and your culture because remember, it was your people that did 9/11 and that was very painful to me. So I must never make jokes about myself ever. I'm not allowed to do comedy because apparently some of my people did 9/11, so therefore I'm not entitled to that job. That's discrimination.
What about there? I mean, there's some people out there who say that you only rose to fame because you could, as a Muslim, plumb all this 9/11 material. What do you think of those people?
That might have been true at that time, 7 years ago. It's not true now.
Right.
When I started, I'd only been doing stand-up 6 months, a year. I wasn't a very good comic. Nobody is after 6 months, a year. And I think probably some people thought I wouldn't last. But all I ever wanted to do, even before 9/11, which is when I started, is I wanted to be a comic. Mm. I wanted to do stand-up comedy. And I wanted to do what all the people I admire do, like people like Richard Pryor and Lenny Bruce, is that they talk about their life. And that's what most comedians do. They talk about their life and their experiences. And this was my life. I talked about my upbringing and my parents and my family. But all of a sudden, I was not entitled to do that because I was Muslim.
But now that you don't wear the hijab when you perform, but there's only so far you can stray, though, right? You'll still always be...
Who I am.
Who you are. And also because, as you say, that you're a bit anomalous. There's not a lot of you out there. You know, a British female Muslim comic. You can't stray from that identity. And therefore, it's where your comedy comes from. Yeah,
but I don't have to talk about being Muslim. I can talk about so many other things, which I'm doing now. Like I talk about meeting the Queen for the first time and what that was like for me. Like I never thought I'd meet the Queen and, you know, the clothes that I wore. Should I wear shalwar kameez or should I wear a miniskirt? Mm. I didn't know what to wear. It was a different experience. But it's not about me being Muslim. It's about me being who I am. And I don't know if people are that. I don't know if it's that shocking for people. When I performed in Vegas for Last Comic Standing, and in Miami, the American audiences, they loved it. It was not such a big deal for them. If it was funny, they laughed.
Right.
If they didn't think it was funny, they didn't laugh.
Right.
And I just didn't think it was that they were that shocked by it.
Do you think that the climate is changing? We've talked to a couple of comedians and comics, Ahmed, who's of Egyptian background and does some of the kind of comedy. A few people who've said, you know, after years of being typecast in films as the terrorist or what, it does. It's starting to feel like there's more openness in the general public to Muslims being funny on stage. Have you noticed a shift at all, or do you feel like we're in the same place we were?
We've never been famous for our comedy. We've been famous for being doctors, lawyers, dentists, and solicitors. And that's a stereotype, but it's true. Like, you know, right. All my brothers and sisters are all those things. And that's what we were brought up to believe. And I was brought up to believe it's okay to watch comedy. It's not all right for you to do it. Because my parents wanted me to be a doctor and do something normal. And I wanted to do this. And I don't think that we're not famous for our humour. And I don't think, I think it was a bit of a novelty in the beginning. Oh, Muslims doing comedy. No, this is for Jews, not Muslims. It's like, no, this is not our territory. So now there's a few of us doing it. And I think, you know, maybe we do, initially we may get stereotyped as a suicide bomber, as the woman in who gets beaten by her husband, wears the hijab, never allowed out of the house. Maybe we will be stereotyped in the beginning. It's going to take a long time to get out of those stereotypes, because people that watch films and music and movies and stuff, they maybe can't see us in different roles.
Do you have any intentions of coming to Canada anytime soon?
I've been to Canada so many times.
And do you have any intentions of coming to Canada anytime soon? Yeah. I know you've got a new show called A Portrait of Shazia Mirza that's going to be at the Edinburgh Festival.
Yeah.
Will you bring that to Canada?
I'd love to bring that.
Will you consider this an invitation?
Yes. Where am I going to do it? At your house?
Sounds we can like arrange that as a beginning.
I'd love to. I've been to Halifax and I've been to Winnipeg. And I've heard that they're not the two greatest cities of Canada.
Oh, they are two of the great cities of
Canada. But I love Halifax. I thought it was great.
And Winnipeg. Well, careful, they're listening.
Winnipeg's great too.
Winnipeg has a great comedy festival.
Yeah, that's the one I did.
Yeah, well, there you go. Yeah. Okay, it was a pleasure to have you here.
Yeah, thank you
for this.
Thank
comedian
you.
Shazia Mirza will perform at the Edinburgh Festival in August. You can check her out at shaziamirza.org, shaziamirza.org for more info. We'll put a link from our website, cbc.ca/Q.
This is Q, the podcast. You can catch Q, the program, weekdays on CBC Radio and several times a day on Sirius 137.
Okay, from London to the Beijing Olympics. We've talked before on this program about the massive amount of building that's going on in Beijing in preparation for the Olympics. And none stands out more than the central architectural symbol of the Games, the so-called Bird's Nest Olympic Stadium, an imposing and complicated construction project that's been 5 years in the making. Helen Couchman is a British art photographer who's been living in Beijing. She wanted an up-close look at the Olympic preparations, so she set out with her camera to find the people who were really making it all happen, not the international architects and design firms, but the workers who actually build the buildings. Couchman took some risks with the project, starting with the fact that she snuck onto the building site to take these images. The portraits that came out of that clandestine session 6 months ago have been collected in a new book simply called Workers. And Helen Couchman is in London on a brief sojourn from Beijing, and she joins me in our studio here. Hello, Helen.
Hello.
Good to have you here.
Thank you.
So, you snuck into the Olympic building site? Is that what you did?
I did sneak into the site. I visited a couple of times and didn't have any luck getting into the site, and eventually had my head and shoulders wedged through the fence in such ridiculous fashion that one of the less sort of official guards took pity on me, and I think he thought I was very funny. Really, just wedged in the fence like that. And I got chatting with him a little bit and ended up taking a picture of him and a couple of his mates. And he was just like, oh, come on then. Let's, you know, come on in.
So taking the picture, it sold him on you, letting you in. You'd think that they would be the opposite. So were you nervous about this, sneaking into the Olympic site, construction site?
Well, my feeling was that the worst could happen was someone would ask me to leave. And I suppose, in a way, I hadn't really thought of the possible repercussions. I just went for it. I felt that my reason for being there was very good and very unthreatening.
And what was your reason for being there? Why were you so eager to get in there?
Well, my work, for many of my projects to date have been about buildings, changes in landscape, and I obviously felt that I should see these iconic buildings. But on a number of visits, I soon realised that I should be photographing the people. But I have to say, the first couple of visits were certainly to see the buildings going up. Mm.
And then why did you decide that you wanted to shoot the people? It's quite captivating as one goes page to page through your book, and we'll describe it in a minute. But why specifically did you shift from the buildings to the people?
Well, it became sort of starkly obvious to me that they were the sort of the focus in the sense that they were the people that were making it happen. And certainly living in Beijing, I'm sure living anywhere in the world, we're well aware that these Olympic Games are, a lot of hope is being pinned on these games. A lot of, China is moving forward and changing and so on. It's being pinned all on these games. And actually, I felt that the people making the buildings were the most exciting part, really, because they'd come so far. They're there in such vast numbers.
What do you mean by they've come so far?
Well, they live in, I mean, obviously some of them are from Beijing, but very few. They tend to come from the poorer rural areas because of migrating for work, simply.
So they're migrant workers.
They are,
in Beijing. You took over 100 portraits of the people you found working on this site. They're all in the same position. They're all looking right into the camera. How did you get them to work with you?
Well, my feeling was straight away that it had to be, I mean, obviously I was unofficial. I wasn't meant to be there. I wasn't really sure of what their feeling about it would be. So when I went back to the site with a very clear intention of taking portraits of the workers, I decided I was going to give it 2 days and that I would say to them, I'm a British artist. I think what you're doing here is great. I would joke with them a little to sort of make them feel at ease. You know, I'd say, oh, I think you're probably a bit famous. And, you know, I think what
you speak the language, obviously. You
know, I do. Yeah. Basically. Right. And I was able to say these basic things. And of course, people stood around and speculated. But slowly, people took a lot of interest. And in fact, over the 2 days I took photos, it was absolutely freezing. So we stood around for a lot of time talking. But basically, over 2 days, I photographed 143 people who all decided that, suspicious or not, I was a good person to take their photo.
Anybody say no?
A few people went by, were busy, whatever. No one came up to me and said they thought it wasn't a good thing, and no one said no as such.
Right. It's strange to think that in all the images that we've seen of this construction and the Olympic buildings that are being built in Beijing, we don't actually see the workers normally. They are unseen in all this. What did you hope to draw our attention to?
Well, simply speaking, at the very beginning, I was feeling that. I consider myself a visual person, but I don't really look at these people. I don't think that makes me unusual. I think we people who live in Beijing and Chinese people and foreign people, workers are in the city and all around China for that matter, in such large numbers. But a bit like anyway, you tend not to look people in the face. So these people are sort of invisible in a sense. And occasionally, obviously, you talk to people because you're waiting for a bus or something, but otherwise you don't register these people. And I really felt that they should be in the centre of the frame, hence the composition of the pictures and the fact that they're all standing in the same spot. I'm reminded of photographs of, say, someone like Louis Hine, who took photographs of workers building the Empire State Building. Yeah. Or I'm sure I've seen similar photographs of people building the Eiffel Tower. And as far as I'm aware, these people are all unknown, but all migrating for work.
Right.
And I just
But from the photos, we don't know much about the workers' jobs or experiences.
No.
Did you know much about their lives or the conditions they face? Or you didn't want to make that a point of this?
The point to start with was not about that. Of course, I am well aware, and I was well aware, that workers' rights in China is a very big issue. And, of course, it would be something that would be brought up with the work. And I'm very comfortable with the idea that if these portraits are looked at, it raises people's awareness of these people as individuals, which I think is a powerful point from that point of view. But I think if my intention had been to make a documentary about workers' rights, it would have been a very different project, possibly more of a documentary project than an art project.
Right. You did a really interesting thing with and for your subjects, your volunteers. You came back the next day. I guess you snuck back in. This is becoming a habit with you. And gave people their photos. Why did you want to do that?
Well, this was essential, because the point of taking the photographs, apart from the initial point, apart from this sort of thought I had about the migrant workers building other iconic buildings in other places in the world at other times, sort of historic document, as it were, was that these people would be the centre. If they were at the centre of the frame, then they would take the photograph that I gave them back to their provinces, to areas probably where people don't have the opportunity to travel to Beijing. I believe everyone has access to television in China. You know, even if you don't have a TV, you're going to go down to the restaurant or over to Auntie's to watch TV. And it's very prominent on television, you know, the Olympics, the countdown for the Olympics, all the greatness and glory it's going to bring. So people are aware of these buildings. They know what's sort of held in the promise of these buildings, but they may never see them. And I really wanted these photographs to sort of, as it were, live on, so that I imagine these will be sort of pinned on the wall of somebody's home, a bit like I might look at a family wedding photograph or a christening photograph. They become part of somebody's personal history.
I know you don't want to situate yourself as some sort of troublemaker, and clearly you made peace with the what did you call them? The unofficial security guards who helped sneak you in. But you do make a point of letting people know that these were unsanctioned photographs. How might they have been different if this had been a project commissioned by or approved by the Chinese government, do you think?
Well, of course, that's a difficult question, because, of course, I'm talking about what I don't know. But I do know that these games are being held up as something extremely glorious, and you know, as it would be in any nation,
sure,
for any nation, to be fair. But I'm not sure whether portraits of workers would have come out that looked like this. Again, I'm only speculating, but my feeling is that, you know, they would have been tidied up and, you know, made to wash their hands. And I wanted to catch people as they were, and as anyone would. A very few of them were a bit concerned. You know, well, I've got dirt on my clothes or something. And I said to them, well, you know, this is the thing. You're men at work. You're making these buildings. This is, you know, you're busy, and so fine. You know, I think you look great as you are.
So there was no sanitizing of the images.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I'm not sure to what extent that would go, but I would dare to say it might go quite far, in the sense that these people probably wouldn't even appear.
So what, as an artist, a photographer living in Beijing, Helen, I want to ask you a little bit about the Beijing art scene. I mean, it seems to be thriving, and yet we still hear about films being banned and work being censored, and Time Out magazine isn't able to publish its June issue. What's the climate like there for making and exhibiting art in the city?
Well, I believe from friends who have been working there longer than I have that it used to be worse, in the sense that I have heard of works being taken down and destroyed over a number of years back. Nowadays, I've certainly had friends' works removed, but they don't tend to destroy it anymore. And I think there is some kind of understanding, although I don't fully understand it myself, where art seems to get a bit more space, seemingly, than other forms of communication, maybe because they feel that the audience is very specific and not maybe so far reaching as, say, newspapers or whatever. But also, I think they've discovered that it's actually rather... Well, Chinese artists are making record-breaking prices now, so it's become quite interesting culturally.
Right.
I don't mean just from the money point of view, but to sort of prove something about China, which actually most Chinese people will never see. So it's quite a safe bet to leave it open.
Although you're not perceived as a Chinese person when you're there as an artist, right?
No.
How do you feel that your relationship is? How the city, the authorities, the people running the place see you?
It's interesting. I wonder if they're not... Well, part of me feels that they take very little notice. But then maybe that's naive. I think probably people are aware of what I'm doing, and they're probably aware of the book. And a few people have said to me, well, do you think, you know, with the publicity the book is getting, do you think, you know, someone will come and, you know, remove the copies or whatever? Of course, I don't know, but I doubt it, in the sense that I think with China, once something's available and out, it's to a certain extent, you know, left be. Mm. I think it's just that the idea that the book might be made initially was possibly a tricky one. But I think now it's done, I think people will see the merit in it. And certainly Chinese friends and the people at the, you know, factories who printed it and bound it and so on have taken, you know, I dare say, delight in seeing these pictures. I think a lot of local people have enjoyed seeing these pictures, and maybe that filters through slowly, or maybe I'm being naive, but so far, so good.
Will you be going to the games?
I certainly will. I haven't got tickets as such. I seem to have managed to slip through the net on that one.
Right. Why would you get tickets when you can...
Well, exactly.
I imagine...
I'm hoping to just take photographs.
Maybe it may not be as easy once the games start.
No. I'm hoping to take photographs. And I actually filled in a form the other day to help with the British team to volunteer. So I might do a few days of that too.
Well, let me ask you this. After the games close in August... the eyes of the world will swing to London, where we are right now, because the next Summer Games are going to be held in 2012 here in London. This city appears to already be deep in preparation. Would you consider doing the same project for London? Maybe this will become your 28 up, you know? every Olympics, there's Helen sneaking into construction sites.
Maybe. I wouldn't put it past me. I'm not sure. I haven't, to be honest, I really haven't thought that far. But I know, of course, that the way I think people tend to think in this country, and also the way maybe curators and artists think in this country, it's very likely that people behind the scenes will get some prominence. There's much more of a culture of involving people, I think, maybe. Arguably. Yeah. I certainly have heard from the architect who came to a discussion in Beijing for the book that the Australians had a book that came out called Men in Hard Hats, I think it was, of people constructing the buildings, which I didn't know about previously. Mm. I just heard it the other day. So I suspect this will come through.
Given that you haven't been thinking about it, if you do shoot these workers in London and for the 2012 Olympics, will you be crediting me and my producers for giving you the idea? Prominently on the cover of the book, I would suggest.
Maybe I should. I have to admit, I think it's crossed other people's minds. I've already had a phone call from a company.
I don't believe it.
A steel company called a publisher in China and said, would I be employed to photograph steel workers at the steel factory? But it takes it into a different realm, so I'm leaving it for a while.
It's nice to meet you. It's a captivating book. Thanks for coming in.
Pleasure.
Appreciate it. Helen Couchman, a British photographer based in Beijing. Her photos of workers at the Olympic building sites in Beijing are collected in a new book called Workers. And you can catch a selection of the photographs from the series at helencouchman.com. We'll put a link to that from our website, cbc.ca/Q. But it is Helen, H-E-L-E-N. Couchman is, I mean, it's spelt the way you would think, C-O-U-C-H-M-A-N. That's the way people would think, right? You've been listening to Q, the podcast. Hey, you can hear Q, the program, every weekday afternoon and evening on CBC Radio 1 and Sirius Satellite 137. I'm Gian Gomeshi. Thanks for listening.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.